the press!
I think President Bush doesn't understand the human cost of war.
No war!
Excess backwardness and excess fundamentalism in the Arab countries. And add oil to the mix, and you have a very explosive nuclear situation.
Tell the press!
No war!
And I don't think we should go to war for oil.
I'll be out here protesting as long as it takes to avert this war.
I realize I shouldn't hate the man. I should hate the war itself.
Tell the press!
No war!
Tell the president!
No war!
Tell the press!
No war!
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, October 23rd. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the Bush administration prepares for a second war with Iraq, the country which possesses the world's largest oil reserves after Saudi Arabia, we thought it would be a good idea to have a discussion about the role oil has played in U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East since World War II. Jerry Quickly, a programmer on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, hosted the discussion on his show Beneath the Surface.
Hello, welcome to a special edition of Peace Watch Day. We're going to be talking here about the importance of oil in U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Middle East. The Bush administration is telling members of the United Nations that its patience with the world and the world's, the world body is running out, and that Saddam Hussein must be removed and soon. But why? Unlike the first time the United States invaded Iraq, little is being said about oil, read with a capital O-I-L, as a reason for going to war. Very little is being said about oil. But of course, the need to secure a reliable source of oil has been at the center of U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East ever since World War II. And joining us now to discuss these issues are Michael Clare, Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, and also Hisham Milhem. He's a D.C. Bureau Chief of As-Safir, a Lebanese-based newspaper. Michael and Hisham, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. So first off, let me see, American policy towards the Middle East is basically driven by two factors, a need to secure access to oil and protecting Israel. At least that's, I think those are two of the primary factors involved. When did securing the energy reserves of the Middle East become one of the primary goals of American foreign policy, Hisham?
Sure. Since the end of the Second World War and the emergence of the Soviet Union as a major rival of the United States in the Middle East, the United States began to establish regional military alliances like the Baghdad Pact to contain the Soviet influence in the Middle East and in the Gulf in particular. And in that direction, the United States did provide a great deal of material and political support to a variety of autocratic regimes in the Middle East, including oil-producing states. And therefore, since the end of the Second World War, oil became one of the two major pillars of U.S. policy in the Middle East, the other being maintaining not only Israel's security, but Israel's military preponderance against the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, can you tell us how important the Persian Gulf region is to the world oil market?
Well, everybody knows that the Middle East, the Persian Gulf region, contains a very large share of the world's supply of untapped oil. About two-thirds of the total of all untapped petroleum reserves lie in the Middle East. So, or I should say the Persian Gulf countries, especially Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, those five countries together house nearly two-thirds of the world's known petroleum supplies. So we're going to always be dependent on this region for oil.
Mm-hmm. And unless we learn to wean ourselves of this nasty black stuff.
Well, exactly right. There is no other solution to our problem of dependency on imported oil except to simply reduce our dependency on petroleum, period. The amount of oil in Alaska, for example, is a pittance compared to what Saudi Arabia has. So the idea of that we could somehow become independent by tapping into the Arctic wildlife refuge is pure baloney.
And Hisham, can you tell our audience about the 1952 Baghdad Pact and basically how it was designed to prevent the Soviet Union from gaining access to the Middle East oil? How important was that in the historical development of the, you know, the political situation in the Middle East?
Well, the Baghdad Pact was supported by the United States and Britain at that time, and it included Iraq, Pakistan, Iran, and Turkey. Turkey also being a NATO member. The linchpin was, of course, Iraq and Iran. With the collapse of with the Iraqi revolution, military coup in 1958, and the fall of the monarchy, Iraq bolted out of the pact. And then later on, the pact became irrelevant with the revolutionary change in Tehran, with the fall of the Shah. The Baghdad Pact was one of the examples of how the United States tried militarily and strategically to contain the Soviet Union, to create fear in the region of an impending southward Soviet movement. The problem also is that, as I said earlier, the United States did lend its support for a variety of autocratic regimes, again, selling weapon systems to a variety of countries there that were of no use to them. And in return, of course, the oil money, the oil revenues returned to the United States in the form of investments and in American bonds and securities and in real estate. So what was left of that oil revenues was wasted either on white elephant projects or on a great deal of corruption and graft. I'm not saying that no money did reach the populations of those states, but a great deal of waste occurred in the last few decades.
Now, the United States has been willing to support some very brutal dictators if they would ensure a steady supply of cheap oil to the West. Michael, what's been the effect of those types of, myopic foreign policy decisions? What's been the effect on the people in the region?
You know, this is a policy that has both winners and losers. The U.S. dependence on Saudi Arabian oil, for example, and Kuwaiti oil and UAE, United Arab Emirates oil, and the others, has been enormously beneficial to the royal family and the sheikhs and the oil magnates and others who benefit from all of this. They've become fabulously wealthy beyond anybody's imagination, so they're certainly winners. The fact is, however, that they've maintained their position of wealth and privilege by suppressing the rest of the population, keeping democracy and political parties and political rights away from most of the people in those countries. And the process of doing so, they've aroused quite a bit of opposition. And it's from this opposition, for example, in Saudi Arabia, the anti-royal family opposition, that Osama bin Laden and many of his recruits have come.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about Hisham? Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship between the U.S. and the Shah of Iran, and you know what prompted that relationship, and what its effects were?
Well, there was a time when the United States wanted to rely on what they used to refer to in the days of Nixon and Kissinger as regional influentials, and Iran was such a regional influential under the Shah, especially in the early 1970s with the increased oil revenues, and the Shah had an incredible military appetite and huge imperial ambitions, if you will. He always believed himself to be a descendant, erroneously, of course, from the great Persian monarchs. And the United States did rely on the Shah, built up his support, not realizing to what extent the Shah's policies have alienated his own population, and that's why in 1979 the United States was faced a huge, surprising revolution in Iran. That was really a popular revolution that ended the reign of one of the most autocratic, brutal regimes in the region. There was another time when the United States wanted to rely on the two pillars in the Gulf, i.e. Iran on the one hand and Saudi Arabia on the other. These policies really, again, as Michael said, did not take into consideration the yearnings of the peoples there for greater political freedom and genuine social and economic development.
Now, basically, in the kind of drawing some conclusions or drawing some analysis from this historical context of what's occurred with both the Baghdad Pact, with the United States' role supporting brutal dictators, particularly in terms of the Shah of Iran. And, of course, the United States is also a strong ally of Saddam Hussein throughout the 1980s as he gassed his own people. And, you know, while Rumsfeld sat looking on, drinking tea from the Iraqi ministry's living room, how eager is the Bush administration now to try to get back to a steady supply of Iraqi oil? It just seems that, you know, the successive U.S. administrations go through all these different, you know, contortions and twists in order to continue to get oil at what appears to be below market rates by almost every other standard across the world. Do you think that has any accuracy, the question I posed?
Well, I think there are really two issues about oil that you have to look at. There's oil in terms of pricing and availability to the United States. That's one concern here. But there's oil in terms of power, the power that is reflected by the control or the domination of oil. And I think for the United States, it's the latter point that's crucial in the short term anyway. That is to say, it's U.S. policy to be the dominant power in the Persian Gulf so that no other power could ever gain control of Persian Gulf oil. Only the United States could exercise that power. And I think that has enormous impact on the global equation, the international equation. I think more than anything else, that's what the Bush administration seeks, is to make sure that nobody else will ever challenge the U.S. to dominate this region, and by dominating it, to control the rest of the world, because all of the countries of the world, or most of the industrial countries, Japan, the European countries, and even China, will be dependent on Persian Gulf oil. So the more we can control that area, the more we exercise power over the rest of the world. Now, having said that, I think that access to Iraqi oil for its own sake is also an important motive for the Bush administration. There's a huge amount of oil there, and gaining control of it would be very important to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to see both parts, the economic part and the pure power part of oil.
Hashem, you wanted to add something?
Yes, just to add to what Michael said, when neoconservative strategic planners like Douglas Feith and Don Rumsfeld and Richard Perle and people in the media like Bill Kristol look at the Middle East and look at Iraq in particular, they see Iraq and they consider Iraq to be what I would call the strategic prize, the grand prize, and it goes beyond oil. They believe that if they can bring up a friendly government in Baghdad or a pro-Western regime in Baghdad, they can achieve a number of objectives, strategic and economic and political, in one fell swoop. A pro-Western Iraq will isolate Iran, will put pressure on Syria, will marginalize Saudi Arabia, will play an incredibly important role in defining the oil politics within OPEC. A friendly government in Baghdad will change the equation in the Arab-Israeli conflict. So you do all these things with one fell swoop. And that's why Iraq represents a grand prize that goes beyond the issue of oil and touches on the issue that Michael mentioned earlier, which is to provide the United States with an incredible anchor in the Middle East that would maintain U.S. influence in that region for a long time to come, especially in these days where you find a greater alienation in Washington here vis-a-vis the old Saudi, Saudi American axis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we should look at Iraq now in that context as being the grand prize that would maintain U.S. influence in the region for a long time to come.
All right. Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to see if I can get a quick comment from you both on. I agree with you, Hashem, that the popular view within the administration is that Iraq represents this grand prize for having massive influence and control in the region. But, you know, there are several analysts and several think tanks that posit a very opposite position, that the United States' involvement and their military involvement in the region and the capacity of taking over Iraq represents a massive destabilization of the Middle East. And with that massive destabilization, become many unknowns are pitched into the mix. And how destabilizing do you think are making these types of warlike moves and actions in Iraq will be? Like I said, we just have about a minute left, so we could try to get a quick answer from you, Michael. That would be great.
Yes. You know, I think a lot depends on the outcome of the war itself. That is, if it's a quick victory, if people cheer the American arrival and there's no civil war or no chaos in Iraq afterwards, things might go one way. They may turn in a rosy direction for the U.S. On the other hand, if the war is prolonged, if there's a lot of house-to-house fighting of Baghdad, if you have internal conflicts between Kurds and Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq, the chaos could spread outward from Iraq to surrounding countries, and the whole Middle East could explode. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge element of chance in here that we really can't expect. We can't predict how it's going to work itself out.
Well, I'd like to thank you both so much, Michael Clare, Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, and also Hisham Milhem, Dedisi Bureau Chief of As-Safir, a Lebanese-based newspaper. Thank you both so much for joining us today on Peace Watch.
Thank you.
Thanks to KPFK and Jerry Quickly for that segment. President Bush made a stop in Bangor, Maine yesterday to attend a Republican fundraiser and rally. Protesters organized by Veterans for Peace were on hand to express their opposition to war in Iraq. Amy Brown, host of Radio Active, was there and files this report.
War. Tell the press,
no war.
Tell the president,
no war.
Tell the press,
no war.
A crowd of about 100 anti-war protesters lined the route to the airport in Bangor, Maine, Tuesday afternoon, hoping to deliver a message to George Bush, who was arriving for a Republican fundraiser. The protest was organized by local members of Veterans for Peace, who are strongly opposed to renewed war in Iraq. Veterans for Peace is a national organization founded in 1985 by ex-military service members. Their mission is to share the horrors they experienced, to increase public awareness of the costs of war, and to work for peace. Ron Warner of Bangor, Maine, is a Vietnam vet. He explains why he was present at the protest.
Vietnam was a terrible experience, and I don't want anyone else to have to suffer that, whether as a combatant or as a civilian caught up in it. I think President Bush doesn't understand the human cost of war. He hasn't experienced it, and his view seems to be a very narrow-minded view where force is the only option. That's what he's been saying right from the start on this issue. He hasn't even considered other options. I'd like to tell him not to invade Iraq, not to wage war, but to use every other means possible to avoid war.
Bob Jones of Surrey, Maine, served in the Army from 1962 to 1968. He says that he believes George Bush understands the price of war, but that he thinks it's worth it.
I think he understands that there will be collateral damage and that that is worth it in his quest for domination of, military domination of the planet.
Everett Cox of Etna, Maine, another veteran attending Tuesday's protest, says he believes that if we go to war, it will be for oil, not democracy or U.S. security.
I have two tours in Vietnam, and I was downtown Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, when the Scud missiles were coming in. My feeling is that America has engaged in a war on poverty, a war on crime, a war on drugs, and we've never come close to succeeding in any of those, so why embark on another one that has no relevance to democracy, little relevance to weapons of mass destruction? It's really a contest between America and Asia as to who gets the oil underneath Iraq. And I don't think we should go to war for oil.
Like the other veterans present, Everett Cox doesn't think that Bush understands the human toll of war.
President Bush hasn't a clue. He was a draft dodger at best, okay? At best. His campaigning and all of the
his experiences, I don't think lend themselves well to the presidency.
Peter Phillips, also of Bangor, served in the Navy during the Vietnam War. During his time in the service, he began to question why the U.S. was engaged in that war, and that questioning led him to make what he calls a political and ethical turn, which led to his becoming a peace activist.
I kind of took a big turn from being pro-Vietnam War to being totally against the war. And this reminds me a lot about what happened in Vietnam. Well, it was the idea of being in a war that didn't make sense for us to be in a foreign country without any clear purpose, with a lot of killing of innocent people, children, not only troops, but also definitely people in Vietnam. Just all the bombings, and it just did not make any sense. And it was a political, certainly, but also an ethical turn for me.
Phillips says that he will continue speaking out for peace even if troops are employed. He does not believe that unquestioning acceptance of the government's policies during times of war demonstrates support for the troops, and he will not be silent.
Definitely not. I'm not now, and I won't be then. I'm going to keep reading and talking, and I really don't believe in bashing people, or I believe in whatever party, whatever doesn't feel right and isn't right, I am going to speak up, and I'm going to speak out. I'm going to do it in a way that's fair and respectful, but clearly and directly.
Ron Warner says he, too, will continue to advocate for peace.
I'll be out here protesting as long as it takes to avert this war. I think being patriotic is defending the Constitution and our civil liberties, not by supporting one man who's intent on waging war.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Amy Brown reporting from WERU in East Orland, Maine, with assistance from Meredith DeFrancesco.
When the Bush administration talks about launching a preemptive strike against the people of Iraq, what is the reality of the consequences of such action? Survivors of Hiroshima know all too well the horrors of the nuclear age. Reem Kathuda from WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., prepared this report.
More than 200 students attended the Growing Nuclear Threat teach-in organized by the Department of History and the Nuclear Studies Institute at the American University in Washington, D.C. last week. There, for 3 hours, the mayor of Hiroshima, Tadatoshi Akiba, a survivor of Hiroshima, Koko Tanimoto Kondo, a many books writer on nuclear issues, Jonathan Schell, and Peter Kuznick, the director of the Anti-Nuclear Studies Institute, discussed the dangers of fighting armament with arms and proposed alternatives.
August 6, 1945. My mother was carrying me, and 8:15 in the morning, whole house crushed, and we were buried. My father is a minister of the church, so we lived in a parsonage, 1.1 kilometer from hypocenter. I'm the youngest survivor of the Hiroshima disaster. But I don't want any children to go through that any kind of a war. I want all the children to have a future. I never thought about the persons who were on the air. I had a harsh feeling. I realized I shouldn't hate the man. I should hate the war itself.
Hibakusha, that's the Japanese word for survivors of the atomic bomb. No one else should go through the experiences that Hibakusha went through. I talked to a person in the State Department today. Citizens' voices have not been considered in the process of decision related to the present crisis related to Iraq. Citizens' voices from Hiroshima have not been heard. A passage from the peace declaration, no annihilation without representation. That means before somebody starts a nuclear war, before somebody decides to use a nuclear weapon, the opinion of the world should be sought. At least that effort should be made. And that process really has not occurred yet. And who represent the voices of citizens? On a day-to-day basis, I think it's the mayors that represent citizens' voices. And I believe that the time has come for mayors to stand up so that we represent the voices of our citizens. And in situations like war against Iraq or use of nuclear weapons. So 20 years of efforts on the part of many cities in the world, local governments, you know, probably could be utilized to avoid a catastrophe. But your voices must be heard. You will have to speak up. And those voices will have to determine the fate of the earth. It is very difficult for any nation to possess nuclear weapons in secrecy. And the international sanctions and other methods, if the world is in a state where nations can communicate with each other, that's very, very doable. So the problem we face is that we start with the assumption that we cannot really establish these channels of communication, and then we'll get into a dead end. But I think that's doable, and that's much better, you know, state.
At the ceremony to commemorate the 57th anniversary of the atomic bombings, Mayor Akiba spoke out strongly. The United States government has no right to force Pax Americana on the rest of us or to unilaterally determine the fate of the world. On the contrary, we, the people of the world, have the right to demand no annihilation without representation. I strongly urge President Bush to visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to walk through that forest and ride that river. I beg him to encounter this human legacy and confirm with his own eyes what nuclear weapons hold in store for us all.
You can't stop the spread of scientific knowledge by force. You can't bomb ideas or scientific formulas out of people's minds with B-52s or B-2s. But you can make an awful mess of the world trying. Preemption is against American traditions. If you listen to the tapes of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when it was proposed that Kennedy carry out a preemptive strike against Cuba, even in those circumstances, his brother Robert Kennedy said, no, we can't have a president conducting a Pearl Harbor. So there's been a strong taboo. In addition, it's clearly and obviously counter to international law, including the Charter of the United Nations. Once you let that cat out of the bag, either you're saying we alone can preempt, in which case you are claiming this kind of imperial role for yourself. In other words, you are the exception. Only the United States can do it. Well, that doesn't work, though. India doesn't buy it. India turns around and says, we'll practice regime change against Pakistan. Israel says, we'll practice regime change. I just heard it just today on the radio, an Israeli spokesman saying, just as you have to carry out regime change in Iraq, so we have to have regime change in Palestine. There it was, right on the radio. Wherever there is conflict with that precedent on the books, the stronger power will say, we can attack. If it's in South Asia, it's nuclear war.
Russia makes the same claim. As soon as Bush talked about preempt, they jumped up and said, we'll preempt against Georgia, because Georgia, they say, is helping out the people from Chechnya who want to get out from under Russian rule. So it's a recipe for international anarchy.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Katkhuda.
And I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back.